Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Our sport is a risky sport.
We are at the mercy of the mountain itself.
Rock covered in snow and ice.
The risk of avalanches from bad weather.
Hypothermia. Altitude sickness. Exhaustion.
It's not a natural environment for survival.
Chasing mountains. Listen now by searching for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, as floods cause havoc and claim lives in Kenya, President Ruto explains what needs to happen.
We will need development resources to repair the roads, to rebuild homes. We will need resources to deal with food security issues. We are working with counties and we are working with development partners to make sure that we have a whole of government and a whole of society approach.
A former British diplomat explains why the UK needs to reset its relationship with the continent. And I went to a gaming conference here in London to meet gamers determined to make Africa and Africans visible in the industry.
As a Nigerian Beijing girl, my heritage is something to be celebrated. And I mean, I'm not the only person who wants to feel seen in games. So for me, it was making sure that all of us feel seen. All of us who have a story to tell are able to tell the stories that we want to tell them in the ways that we deserve to tell them and in characters and ways that we need to feel seen.
It's Tuesday, the 30th of April. First, we go to Kenya. The country has been underwater for weeks now as floods sweep everything in its path. People, houses, roads, livestock, everything. Latest figures show that upwards of 170 people have lost their lives so far. Tanzania, Burundi, Uganda and Ethiopia are also experiencing heavy rains. But the images out of Kenya are horrific. Huge swathes of Nairobi are submerged in water. The airport and cargo areas were flooded. Major highways and railways have been swept away. And can you imagine what it's like for people living in informal settlements, like living in houses built with flimsy materials? And there's the whole horror of villages like Mai Mahiu, where an overflowing reservoir burst, killing at least 50 people. These tragedies are multiplied across the region. Our concerns were compounded by the fact that our colleagues Charles Kitonga and Richard Kagoe live in Nairobi. So we decided to check in on them before exploring the broader issues raised by these floods. I spoke to Charles because Richard had his hands full dealing with a flood in his neighborhood. Charles, we just need to check in with you. Massive floods all over the country. Nairobi absolutely underwater. It's very worrying. We're seeing really concerning pictures. Several people have died. How are you doing? Are you safe and dry?
Well, I'm safe and dry because where I live is on the upper side of Nairobi. So most of the water that we see is sort of going to the lower parts as it would normally when there's a flood. It's raining massively. You have to drive through inches of water to come to work, for instance. The rain comes in the afternoon at around 4 p.m. local time, and it will go all the way to 2 a.m. the following morning. And so it's a lot of water. I have not experienced the kind of flooding that a lot of people are dealing with right now.
Everybody in Nairobi knows somebody who's affected by the floods, if they are not affected by the floods. We know somebody who's been affected by the floods, right, Richard?
Yeah, a colleague, Richard, has not been so lucky as I have been. Where he lives is towards the southern part of Nairobi. So it's along the major highway that connects Nairobi, which is the capital city, to Mombasa, which is the coastal city and a huge commercial hub. So on that sort of route, there's been a lot of flooding, and that's along where Richard lives. And so he's had to deal with the rivers busting, you know, and causing massive flooding into his neighborhood. He's been managing to come to work, but I think you are not guaranteed because you come to work and you go home and you find water. I think he told me his basement is flooded where they park their vehicles. So that's the kind of scenario that he's dealing with alongside his neighbors as well.
He hasn't been able to join us. Yesterday he was called away because the floods were reaching his neighborhood, and he's going to be away for a couple of days. We'll check in with him as soon as he gets back. But tell me what's happening with the rest of the country and just bring us up to date with the figures.
So you're looking at nearly 200,000 people affected from across the country now, and 33 counties. So counties are sort of like regional governments in Kenya. There are 47 of them, and 33 of them have been affected. Towards the end of last year, there was this information that we were going to have an El Nino kind of phenomenon, and there was going to be a lot of rain towards December and end of November. It did not happen. So at the beginning of March, the rain has been coming in such volumes that people did not anticipate. There had been early warning signs by the departments that should be doing that. However, people were not sort of prepared. The government looks like it wasn't adequately prepared as well. In terms of the death toll, we are looking at well over 100 people dead because of that flash flood that's towards the northern part of Nairobi, about 60 kilometers outside of Nairobi, where a massive reservoir of water just collapsed and swept half a village.
Oh, so tragic. Thank you very much, Charles, and I hope you stay safe and dry. And I know that our listeners will be wishing everyone well as they deal with these floods. And we'll hear from Richard when he returns. Thank you.
Thank you, Audrey.
Charles Kitonga, one of the few people fortunate enough to be safe and dry in Nairobi for now. We'll be hearing from President Ruto in a moment, but let's talk first about the reasons why Nairobi and other cities in East Africa appear to be so unprepared for these floods. Tom Odongo is an urban planning expert and fellow at the Kenya Institute of Planners. So what is it about Nairobi and its location that makes it so prone to flooding? Because this is not the first time that we've seen floods in the city.
Nairobi generally was located in a basin, what basically a river basin, and is an area that was partially swampy and was prone to flood because of the waters coming from the Ngong River escarpment and the Central Highlands. The development originally Nairobi had no much population. It started with 500,000, get to about 800,000. But now we have a population of 4 million. The challenge we have now is that majority of the waterways suffer from waste blockages that is related to the way in which solid waste management system is working in Nairobi. The other aspect of it is that a huge number of informal settlements are located along the riverbanks, and these are the areas with the poorest solid waste management services, which means that the river also functions as a dumping site.
Right. And so these problems are going to grow worse, right, if something isn't done, because the city is growing and so does the need for housing and factories and all of that. So what can be done, what should be done in order to mitigate this?
We need to have an urban planning that is risk-informed. And somehow we have some plan that was done in 2014, but the bigger problem, that was a big framework. So what we need is to now go into what we call local area plans that would be able to go into details in terms of risk-informed urban planning approaches. And this can also be able to help in bringing some of the controls that are actually structural. Like, for example, how do you mitigate on flood measures by way of controlling land uses, way of restricting the way developments are done, what we call zoning restrictions, and also evaluating also the impact of the current plans so that we are able to also look at which other non-structural ways can be applied to respond to the flood. Some of those none could be about building community resilience. How can we use communities to be able to be part of that effort to be able to mitigate the impact of floods and reduce also the impacts?
So you want strict planning rules, you want clear stormwater drains. We also want somebody to be keeping an eye on rising water levels, right? To say, well, actually, this looks like it's going to be a big one. We need to start thinking about what we're going to do should floods happen. So why is it that those things have fallen by the wayside, though?
I think the major problem is that for a long time, and this is not just a Nairobi problem, it's more like a of African cities problems, in the sense that you do not find investment in frameworks. The political leadership tend to like doing projects because they are more concerned about how they can win elections in the next cycle. And frameworks are not prioritized for funding. So what you'd find in the case of Nairobi, planning decisions are made based on discretion rather than on very, very clear plans that are very clear in terms of which future are we looking at. So development is taking place without detailed regulations. And when flooding is also coming, we also don't have frameworks that guide in terms of how do we invest in infrastructure to be able to improve management of surface water.
Tom Odongo from the Kenya Institute of Planners. Now, as promised, President Ruto, responding to calls for a national emergency to be declared, he's been speaking to my colleague, Rhoda Odhiambo.
So while it is true that we have an emergency situation and we need to respond, every level of government has been built into the budget that a certain percentage of their budget can be reorganized to meet emergency requirements. It is the reason why, as early as last week, we already had food items being sent out to places where there are floods. As I talk to you, a whole of government approach is underway to deal with the flooding, to deal with the mudslides, and all the other attendant issues. We will need development resources to repair the roads. We will need resources to rebuild homes for those who have been affected. We will need resources to resettle. We will need resources to deal with food security issues. We are working with counties and we are working with development partners to make sure that we have a whole of government and a whole of society approach to the challenges that
we
have.
So would you say, in terms of response, would you be blaming county governments for making the response not adequate enough, given the fact that you've already mentioned that they have emergency budgets within them, but they've not been able to reallocate them?
I don't think this is the moment for blame game. I think we should just address ourselves to the issues, move with speed to respond, and also ask citizens to move away from areas of danger, areas where there are possibilities of floods.
Given the warning that has been issued by the Kenya Meteorological Department and other scientists about the impact of the heavy rainfall, not only in Kenya, but other East African countries, won't it be the right time to declare flooding a national disaster, given the number of people who've died, the infrastructure that has been destroyed, and those who've been displaced?
I think the more urgent thing to do is to provide the requisite resources, put in place the necessary plans, as we are doing. I already called an emergency multi-agency team last week to be able to set up a 24-hour emergency desk that will look at all the issues around the situation we are faced with. And I am very confident that we should be able to respond in good time. If it gets to a level where it becomes absolutely necessary for us to declare a national disaster, then those steps will be carried out.
And that's President William Ruto speaking to Rhoda Odhiambo in Kenya. Britain is due to have an election sometime this year, and analysts say the incumbent Conservative Party is in real danger of being kicked out after 14 years in government. In that time, the UK has been convulsed by terror attacks, a vote to leave its biggest trading partners in the EU, Brexit for short, and there's been a real shrinking of its role on the world stage and on the continent as China, India and Russia step up their dealings with various African countries. Against this backdrop, a former UK diplomat says this is the perfect moment for Britain to reset its foreign policy, basing it on honesty and respect among equals. Tim Cole served as deputy head of mission in Zimbabwe and Mozambique until a few years ago. He was also the head of the Pan-Africa Policy Unit. He was Save the Children's Program Director for the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he ran the Christian Aid Program in Central Africa. We invited him to explain what he meant by an honest relationship.
Well, what I mean is, I think currently the partnership is one where there isn't very much trust between the UK and Africa. I think the UK isn't really seen as delivering on its promises. To some extent, it's still a sort of relationship between the former colonial power and former colonies. It's not a healthy, productive, balanced relationship that you would want in foreign policy. So that's what needs to change. And I think there's a real actual opportunity because there's going to be an election in the UK sometime this year. And if the polls are anything to believe, then it's very likely the Labour Party will form the next government. And the Labour Party's shadow foreign secretary, David Lammy, has set out what his sort of theory of foreign policy will be, what Labour's foreign policy will be if they get into power, which is about being progressive, so pursuing progressive objectives like countering climate change, defending democracy, etc., but being realistic about how you do that.
Before we go too much further into the possibilities of the future, let's just quickly unpack a couple of things. So when you say Africa, do you mean across the board? Because, I mean, Britain hasn't had an across-the-board relationship with the African continent, right? Do you mean specific countries?
Well, I would say it's had a strategy for Africa for quite a long time. I mean, going back to 2005 when Tony Blair prioritized Africa in his G8 presidency. I was involved in the negotiations then, and that covered everything from aid to trade to building peace, security, operation capacity, to good governance, to pretty much everything. So I think the UK has, at least in its own mind, always had that pan-continental African strategy.
I'm just wondering whether there's a separation between business interests and how it has dealt with Africa and how the government has dealt with the continent, because business-wise, British interests have been very, very prominent on the continent and might be waning now, but they definitely were very much so until, you know, quite recently.
That's true. And that's been very much, I think, the focus of the current Conservative government in the UK is to try and work with business to help, well, build their businesses in Africa, but also to support the growth of African industry and African business. So I think that has been part of the strategy. But again, I think it's not been enough. And I think there are a number of different policy decisions that have been made where Africa, so whether that's the African Union, Africa as a continent, or one of the many countries in Africa, have actually felt a little bit shortchanged by the UK and have been disappointed, I think, by some of the positions they've taken. I mean, that's, for example, if you look at, look during the pandemic where the vaccines were really hoarded in Western countries like the UK and weren't shared equally with African countries. That was a, you know, particularly difficult stage. I think now, you know, when you look at the conflicts around the world, I mean, the UK is very much working very hard in Ukraine and in Gaza. But what it's doing in Sudan, for example, where there are many more people actually who are affected by the conflict, you know, more than, I think it's 9 million people now who've been displaced. You know, you're not seeing the same level of diplomatic effort by the UK in countries like that as you are in other places.
Did you, as a diplomat in the time that you were active on the continent, feel uncomfortable with the colonial overhang that you were talking about earlier?
Not really. I mean, I think now it's become much more prevalent in my mind, much more obvious, I think. I think partly because African voices now are much more at the center of debate. I was involved, for example, with an NGO for the last 4 years. And what we tried to do is make sure that it was Africans who were talking about climate change in Africa, not white men like me, for example. So I think increasingly the voice of Africa is being heard and being heard by people like me. But I'm not sure that's being heard in Whitehall and Westminster. And I think that's why we have this opportunity, because if the Labour Party do form the next government, then I think things will change.
Right now, we're seeing lots of African countries pivoting towards Russia, China, India, seeing other interests that they can merge with that are not as, shall we say, to pick up on a thread that you had said earlier, that are more direct and more honest dealings with the countries that they deal with. What would you say the UK can do to lead people to pivot away from those countries? Because right now, it seems like the distance between some African countries and the rest of the West and the UK is growing quite fast.
I think there are lots of things the UK can do. So if the government decides to reset its relationships with Africa, I think it has to say, right, we want a relationship that is equal. We've got a partnership of equals. It's all about real partnership. This is a partnership of dialogue, shared objectives, shared respect, all those sorts of things. And then there are particular things that can be done. For example, we need to have a discussion about colonialism, about Britain's colonial past. I mean, I think there needs to be a proper apology for that that's unconditional. I mean, King Charles expressed regret and sorrow for abuses when he was in Kenya 6 months ago, but he didn't go as far as making that sort of apology. We need to make sure that we are really dealing, I think, with the issue of sort of the items that were stolen during our colonial history that are in UK museums and public institutions. We need to meet the commitments we've made on climate finance, for example. I think we need to return the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, which is the last British colony in Africa. And it's a long-running sore, I think, between Africa and the UK. And then I think there's other things we could do, which is about supporting the African political agenda. So, for example, Africa for a long time have made the case for them to have a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. It's never been completely clear which country they think should have that seat. And while, you know, while the UN Security Council is still, the seats are held by countries, it has to be a country, it can't be the African Union. But I think the UK could really, you know, make the public case, lead that charge alongside Africa in making the case for things like Africa to have that permanent seat.
Were you saying these things when you were a diplomat?
No, I'm saying them now because I think there's an opportunity now. I mean, I think in those days it was slightly different. I mean, I left the Foreign Office in 2019. Because
not so long ago.
It's not so long ago, no. I was involved with Africa a bit earlier than that. And I don't think many people were making the case because, as I said earlier, I think the conversation has changed. It feels now much more people are aware of these different issues. It's not the geopolitical battle between China and Russia and the UK and France and all that sort of stuff. That's not really, I think, what motivates these ideas and these arguments. It's much more about recognizing African agency, African primacy, the importance of really how African political leaders, not just political leaders, but also Africans across the whole range of society, how they can and do make the case for their continent and for their countries and argue for what they want.
They'd always been doing that. 2005 marked a moment, but the momentum seemed to have been lost. Why do you think that was the case?
Well, since then, we obviously had a change of government. So we've had, for the last 14 years, a Conservative government in the UK. And I think leaving the European Union has actually reduced the UK's ability to work alongside the European Union, have those conversations alongside the European when it comes to foreign policy.
Now, of course, the conversations these days in the world are about resources, scarce resources, resources needed to build future worlds. The continent, as always, has those resources. We're talking about the rare minerals and metals that are needed to build a greener future. It seems that the UK sort of disengaged from the continent, even if you look at, for instance, its involvement at the broadcast level with the BBC. It seems like it disengaged from the continent at a crucial time when China and those other countries were deepening their involvement in the continent. So why would African countries turn back to the UK now, do you think?
Yeah, they might not. If you reset the relationship in a way that I described, in the way that puts African priorities and African agency at the front of it, then I think Africa would look at the UK in a different light and say, OK, let's work out how we work together. On things like critical minerals, there are things that the UK can support African countries with, capital and technologies, for example. But I think at the end of the day, the objective of that support has to be African self-sufficiency and African, what is the African benefit? How do their economies benefit from these sorts of industries? Because, you know, in the past, you've often seen that those extractive industries have actually meant extraction, and a lot of the benefit has gone to Western companies, Chinese companies, etc. So I think that's crucial, is that African self-sufficiency and that African capacity. But there are things, I mean, there are British mining companies who can help as well. There are some who are still in Africa, for example, who the UK or other countries could partner with alongside the African governments or their industries. So I think there is something there. But yes, you're right. I mean, China has a hold on much of the upstream mining of critical minerals in Africa. But yeah, I think there's potential there. So I think the UK can bring something to the game. But I think the important thing is the objective of that support, of that investment, has to be, you know, what Africans want.
Now, you're a former diplomat. We're projecting that the Labour Party may very well be the next government. I'm wondering, if they aren't, would a Conservative government, or any government for that matter, see this reset as critical? Or is there still resistance? Because you've set out the terms for that reset, the proper apology for slavery, the return of resources, etc., of precious artifacts, all kinds of things that are quite sticky for people in this country. Do you think that any one of those governments is prepared to take it on?
I think so, yes. The important thing is that they sit down with African leaders and say, right, we are here. We want to change our relationship with you. What do you want? What is your priority? What do you want us to be doing differently in order to support your agenda and your objectives. I think that's the important thing. And so some of these issues, they may not be the number one things on the list for the African Union, for example, or for the Nigerian government or for whoever it is. There may be other things that they would want to put on the table. But I think that's the crucial thing, is that the next government sits down with African leaders and says, here we are, right, this is different. Because ultimately, you know, as we all know, Africa is the continent of the future. The population is rising when the populations of countries like the UK are falling. So our futures are very much intertwined. Our economies are going to be more and more intertwined over the coming decades. And we really do need to work together, whether it's on the green transition, addressing our history, everything else. We really do need to work together as a, you know, in a, that real strong strategic partnership.
Tim Cole, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
That's the former UK diplomat, Tim Cole. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe, from people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been getting out of the studio quite a bit recently. In the last episode of Focus, you heard me at the Barbican Centre. Today, we're at the London Games Festival, an annual extravaganza of video games. Now, I'm not a gamer, but I was really interested to find out about a new game that builds on mythologies from the continent. Tales of Kenzera Zao has been creating quite a buzz among gamers, bringing to the console the story of a young man's experience of grief following the death of his father. The quest uses legends from the Bantu, a huge linguistic group that stretches from the armpit of Africa, across the rainforests of Central Africa, down the Rift Valley of East Africa, and into the savannah of Southern Africa. As you can imagine, African gamers are stoked. It's taken a lot of hard work by black and women game developers to move away from the stereotype of gaming being dominated by young white men. I spoke to a few people about this. Abubakar is the man behind the game Tales of Kenzera. Danielle has been pushing the boundaries of representation in gaming, but we began with a couple of African gamers checking out the festival.
My name is Alessandra, and I'm half Kenyan and half Ugandan. African narratives are something I definitely want to see more of. I feel like I don't see enough of them within industry. And I think that we've got like a lot of different cultures and stories that we could like pull from to tell. I feel like it's just kind of underutilized, you know? And I'd like to see variety. So not only like West Africa, East Africa, South Africa, very north of Africa, you know, like introduce people to cultures that they might not be as familiar with.
Hi, my name is Asosa and I'm from Nigeria. When it comes to stories of African narratives, there's not many. I feel like that's something that does need to change, because there's a lot to enjoy, right? The world's a big place, many different places. Why not, you know, why not Africa?
I'm on my way to do an interview with Abubakar, who's just waiting for me as we walk through out of the sound of the main hall, where everybody's milling around and talking about games and looking at games and playing games and loving games. Let's go. Okay. What I want you to do is tell me your name and your surname.
My name is Abubakar Salim.
And tell me a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so I'm an actor, but most importantly, I'm the founder and creative director of Surgeon Studios.
Yeah, but what does those studios do? Why are we talking to you today?
So you're talking to me because we've just released our debut game, Tales of Kenzera Zao, on all platforms. Because, yeah, we make video games.
Wow. And what's special about Kenzera Games? Because they have video games and video games and video games.
Yeah.
What's special about your one?
So our one is very much inspired by Bantu mythology, myths and legends. And really, truly, actually, the game stems from my experience of grief, my journey of grief after having lost my father.
So what is the myth and legend? What is the story that Kenzera is telling us?
So Telza Kinzera Zao follows a young shaman, warrior shaman called Zao, who makes a deal with the god of death Kalunga that in exchange for three great spirits, he will bring his father's spirit back. He's a grieving young boy. And so you go on this journey within this mythical land of Kinzera, and essentially you'll be interacting with all sorts of mythological beasts like the Mpundulu, you know, the Gagorib. And essentially this is the world that we're playing in.
And your game, people can play it in Swahili as well, right? The soundtrack can be in Swahili.
Mm. So this was important for me, you know. When I pitched this to EA, I said to them that I wanted the game to be voiceovered fully in Swahili. And they had never done that before. But again, for me, it was, again, reaching out to people who wouldn't have necessarily felt seen beforehand in mediums to be like, ah, I want to jump into this world because of the fact that they are speaking in Swahili, you know?
So tell us about the reasons why you think there's so few African stories or stories that build on African myth and mythology, where we see Norse mythology, we see so many other different forms of mythical storytelling in games, but not African.
I think it's because a lot of the storytellers who want to tell these stories aren't in positions or in spaces to be able to tell them, right? I've been very fortunate that I'm working with EA, Electronic Arts, who are a big publisher, who are most notably known for doing, you know, FIFA or Madden sports games. But they've given me this chance to do something really, really powerful and really honest and true. And I think we need more people to do that.
Tell me about the issues that stand in the way of bringing it to an African market?
I think it's just awareness. I think ultimately, you know, a lot of these games, we are selling and advertising to the Western media or to the Asian media as well. Whereas to really kind of break through in Africa, it is just about awareness. It's about having conversations like this, you know, being exposed more within the African space as well.
I suppose we can say that people can spend their money on what they want to. And if they don't know this, then they won't necessarily want to spend their money on it. So how do you grow the market?
I think by having more young people get into the games industry, by seeing games as a medium that isn't necessarily a waste of time, but as another way of expressing yourself.
Is the world waiting for gamers from Africa and game designers from Africa?
I think it's ready. They're hungry for it. You know, we're in a place now where you have all these stories that are being told, the same stories all the time, and we need something new, we need something fresh, and we need something bold. And I think the more we can invite African storytellers to come and tell us these cool stories and give us new experiences, a new perspective, I think it will push technology to another level.
Fabulous. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Danielle Yidogaranya.
Are you London-born?
I am London-born. My mum is from Barbados and my dad is from Nigeria.
Right. What brings you here?
Well, one of the many reasons is because I am part of this year's ensemble, which is a celebration of the kind of minority groups who are doing amazing things within the gaming industry.
Are you a gamer?
Oh, I am more than a gamer. It's in my bloodline. My dad was a gamer, so it definitely feels like a genetic thing at this point. I've always had consoles and games in my family. My uncle's a game designer as well. So gaming has just been a part of my life forever.
What I noticed from what you were saying there, you were talking about men gamers and men gamers introducing you into gaming. Is it unusual for women to be in gaming?
I would say it's not unusual for women to be gamers, but the visibility of women in games is what is the unusual thing. There are so many women that I know who are excelling in the gaming industry and have only been celebrated within the last few years.
I'm wondering, what were the barriers to them being visible before?
So the barriers for women being visible was just because gaming was seen as a bit of a boys' club. It was very much a male-dominated space. It was boys play games and girls play with dolls. And so it was very binary for a very long time. But as women have started to show their interest in gaming over the last few years, and quite openly as well, so there's kind of not that fear of being shunned or seen as like an other. And so with that kind of confidence and that kind of assurance that, yes, playing the game is fine if you're a girl or a guy or non-binary, like, it doesn't matter. Everyone can play games. But being a black woman in gaming has been a tremendous struggle, just from one, visibility, but two, even just being celebrated for the work that you do, for creating safe spaces, for allowing other women to feel seen and feel protected in a space that wasn't made for them.
So what do you do within the industry?
So I'm quite a multifaceted individual when it comes to the gaming industry. So if I start out by saying I taught myself how to 3D art because I saw a lack of representation in games.
You taught yourself?
How to do 3D modeling, so 3D art. So what that is that when you go to make a character in a game and you get the option to choose, you know, what your skin tone looks like, what your hairstyles looks like, usually we're limited to three options or less, which is the afro, the single locks that go backwards or to the side, and a low fade. So for me, I was really frustrated with that and kind of had enough and taught myself how to do better and be better. So I created more curls, locks, throws, everything that allowed us to feel seen in games and shared it with my community. And then kind of following from that, I just kind of built up a massive platform to highlight the need for representation in games. And I've got a consultancy now called Evola 2. So I consult with, I guess, companies and game studios to kind of make sure that they are tapping into the nuances of different cultures when it comes to creating their games, so that it's not just a tick box exercise that, yes, we've got someone black, or yes, we've got someone Asian.
Or that we have a games figure that the skin tone is black and they've got sort of vaguely blackish hair, but the figure doesn't look like a different kind of person, all of those things. So you making gaming beautiful and varied.
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, as a Nigerian Beijing girl, my heritage is something to be celebrated. And, I mean, I'm not the only person who wants to feel seen in games. So for me, it was making sure that all of us feel seen. All of us who have a story to tell are able to tell the stories that we want to tell them in the ways that we deserve to tell them, and in characters and ways that we need to feel seen. So, I mean, there are more people now in the rooms who are able to say yes and no's and actually craft really beautiful stories around African heritage. I mean, you spoke to Abu earlier, and he is just a prime example of what it's like to have someone who looks like you in the room creating stories and narratives, being inclusive. Now, you're just telling a story about grief, but it's hosted and depicted in the most beautiful way around blackness and Kenyan culture and heritage. And I just think it's so lovely to see that there's ways for us to be seen outside of the stereotypes, and that our stories are there to be told in the most beautiful ways and not held to the very negative regards that we usually are.
Danielle Udogaranya is the founder of Evolutu. Abubakar Salim is from Surgeon Studios, and he's also an actor. You can see him in the upcoming House of Dragons. And of course, Alessandra and Asosa. Happy gaming, gamers. Focus on Africa was put together by Charles Gitonga in a flooded Nairobi, but he's okay. Bella Hassan, Nyasha Michelle, Patricia Whitehorn and Rob Wilson did their bit here in London. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist in charge of operations. Jonathan Greer was the technical producer responsible for getting us on air and online. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.